Now, the costs are differential in different countries, and that's a much broader argument. Same as with drugs and the price of healthcare and the price of healthcare insurance in particular. But yes, a scan is always cost-effective compared to a biopsy. And that's even before you start thinking of the fact that liver biopsy carries a 2.4% major complication rate.
Welcome to the AWS Health Innovation Podcast, where you can learn from entrepreneurs and investors who are driving progress in healthcare and life science around the globe. Hi, everyone. I'm Alex Merwin from AWS. Today, we're joined by Rajashree Banerjee, also known as Banjo, the CEO of Perspectum, who's revolutionizing the way we diagnose and monitor chronic diseases. Perspectum's medical imaging software applies artificial intelligence to enhance MRI scans, providing greater precision in measuring organ inflammation. By providing an option for non-invasive virtual biopsies, they avoid complications associated with invasive approaches and are expanding their focus beyond liver disease to conditions like diabetes and breast cancer. Hosting Banjo on today's show is Amrita Sarkar from Amazon Web Services. Banjo shares his journey from research fellow to entrepreneur, and we will learn all about the innovative work Perspectum is doing to improve diagnostics and patient outcomes. Let's get started.
Hello, everyone. I'm Amrita Sarkar, and I'm your host for the AWS Health Innovation Podcast today. I am a principal healthcare and life sciences business development manager for venture capital and startups at Amazon Web Services. This means that I work with the CEOs, founders, and investors behind some of the world's most innovative healthcare and life sciences startups, and I help them build and operate at scale, accelerate their time to market, overcome technical and regulatory challenges, and of course, win more business. In terms of background, I'm a mathematician and computational biologist by training, and I was a venture capital investor in healthcare and life sciences companies for a number of years prior to joining AWS. We're very excited to have Dr. Rajashree Banerjee, the CEO of Perspectum, with us today. Hi, Rajashree. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Amrita. Please feel free to call me Banjo as well.
Okay. So Banjo, your journey from being a research fellow at the University of Oxford to becoming the CEO of Perspectum is truly remarkable. Could you share with our viewers some key turning points or pivotal moments in your career that led you to pursue this path of entrepreneurship in the field of precision health technology?
Of course, Amrita. Happy to. I have to say a lot of it is serendipity and luck. I was a cardiologist in training in London, Southeast England. And I wanted to learn how to do cardiac MRI, partly because I wasn't very good at doing cardiac ultrasound. And the only way you could learn cardiac MRI back then was to do a PhD in it. And so I did. And in the course of that PhD, I met Matt Robson. And at the end of that PhD, I met Mike Brady, with whom I co-founded Perspectum. And we effectively learned how to do virtual biopsies or tissue characterization without needles. And that's a key part of medicine. Understanding what's wrong with your body by being able to see it is really useful in making a diagnosis. And in the past, there's a big sign in Massachusetts General Hospital's second floor outside the pathology department that says tissue is the issue. So historically, doctors have always stabbed patients to find out what's wrong with their innards. Seems not a great strategy for customer retention, and it seems to be a bit of an imbalance in the power dynamic between the doctor and the patient. So finding non-invasive, safe ways of looking into a patient and being able to then show them the picture so that they own their data was very much an accidental finding coming from the vagaries of medical ultrasound.
What a fascinating story. And I can say personally, I'm happy that non-invasive methods of finding out what's wrong with our innards are taking precedence over the traditional ways of jabbing people and taking out tissue samples.
Yes. And one thing I'd say, Amrita, is if it doesn't get too political, it's even worse for women. But for issues where most research funding has not been directed over the past several decades, for example, endometriosis, The current way of diagnosing endometriosis is with a diagnostic laparoscopy for a condition that affects, you know, 1 in 10, maybe 1 in 12 women globally. I think if we're down to the point that we can have consumer space travel, we should probably be able to do better in how to diagnose 10% of women who may have a chronic inflammatory condition. So we're one piece of the pie, but I really believe that digital advances in healthcare and partnership with patients and physicians will literally move the needle out the way.
Indeed. So in terms of a product that Perspectum has developed, Liver Multiscan, which was developed during your time at Oxford, has significantly impacted clinical practice with its FDA clearance and has widespread adoption now. So what inspired you to focus on a liver assessment, and how do you see this technology evolving in the future?
So we were scanning the heart, and if you do what they call a short axis view of the heart, you always see the liver in the bottom left of the screen. So we were seeing the variation in liver tissue characteristics in a variety of patients, whether they put on weight or lost weight or so on and so forth. And we could clearly see different signals in people who had quantitatively excess fat in their liver and evidence of inflammation. And then when I went to speak to the liver doctors, I said, how do you confirm this diagnosis? They said, oh, we always biopsy the liver, much like we talked about earlier. And so we ran the study that, can I predict what your liver biopsy will find? And it was one of those fairly nice studies where you don't really need a statistician. By the fourth patient, we'd filed two patents and we knew we could do it. And the problem with liver biopsy is, as a method for assessing liver disease, is very widespread. In the US, population about 330 million, about 100 million people have liver disease. I don't think you have enough needles and local anesthetics to do that. So we really needed a non-invasive test for liver disease at exactly the time point that I was lucky enough to be part of the team that discovered that you could replace liver biopsy.
Yeah, and I imagine also from a purely market perspective, the impact on cost is significant as well when you're able to do a scan rather than a biopsy to detect the condition.
Amrita, this is very true. No matter what healthcare system you're in, whether you're in Portugal or Germany, the Netherlands, the UK, or the US, if you compare the unit cost of a biopsy and the unit cost of an MRI scan powered by a technology, the scan is always cost effective. Now, the costs are differential in different countries, and that's a much broader argument. Same as with drugs and the price of healthcare and the price of healthcare insurance in particular. But yes, a scan is always cost effective compared to a biopsy. And that's even before you start thinking of the fact that liver biopsy carries a 2.4% major complication rate. So if I biopsy 50 people, I will have most likely physically harmed one of them, requiring either blood transfusion or hospitalization or liver surgery. And then when you add that cost on, it's clearly in favor of non-invasive testing.
Absolutely. And not to mention that it would scare people away from going for a biopsy. Conditions might remain undetected, whereas people are much more willing to subject themselves to a scan.
Oh, the marketing of diagnostic tools it's quite interesting to the point of amusing. So when you market biopsy needles, your audience is a hepatologist or a surgeon. And so the top-selling liver biopsy needles, branded TrueCut needles, like, they're really sharp. That's not really patient-focused, is it? Whereas on the other side, you have companies like Philips, to make MRI more accessible to children, have partnered with Lego and Disney. Okay. Maybe it's me, but I prefer Lego and Disney to sharp knives.
Me too. I think you have a lot of company there. Okay, so now, you know, that we've discussed the liver scan, Perspectum has in fact expanded its focus beyond the liver now and onto other conditions like long COVID, diabetes, and cancer. So as CEO, can you elaborate on your strategic decision-making process behind this diversification and how it aligns with your company's vision for personalized medical care?
course. So from a basic medical viewpoint, if you start off being able to replace a needle to achieve the same goal of tissue characterization, actually with a better endpoint, because a needle only samples a small amount of tissue, whereas with a scan, you can see the whole liver or kidney or pancreas or breast, whatever your zone of interest is. Once you establish a foothold and the viability that you could replace biopsy in liver disease, as the company grows and you deliver into that market, the liver science becomes really operational and directed towards commercialization. So have we produced the evidence to get into clinical guidelines such that insurers will cover us and doctors know about us? And we've done that in liver disease. So we're in 4 clinical guidelines and all that sort of stuff. But we have the technology, the platform to replace not just liver biopsies, but all biopsies. And then, and I guess this is what you allude to, Amrita, there's always this tension about let's seize all the ground, but let's focus enough to actually seize it and build a moat around it and deliver great products to patients. So we've done better in some areas compared to others. So for example, we have some brilliant data in the pancreas and some brilliant data in diabetes. And the two kind of go together. If you can image the pancreas, which produces insulin, you can determine who has diabetes due to excess weight and who has diabetes due to inflammation of their pancreas. And the treatments for those may be very different. And there are other areas where we've had some sort of exploratory dabbles. Could we replace, for example, breast biopsy or some exploratory breast surgery in certain breast conditions like ductal carcinoma in situ? And we've done some small studies in that. But then it becomes a question of where do we deploy capital? And we focus more on metabolic conditions just because that is the single biggest area of drug development right now. But we also have a parallel stream in what we call radiogenomics, so personalized care for cancer using imaging plus genomics. I hope that gives you an idea of my daily tussle between focus and breadth.
Absolutely. And it's fascinating. It's a great area of focus now, especially combining different data sources, genomic data plus maybe lifestyle data and other sources of data to have an approach that's really tailored to the patient. Okay, so my next question will be about the way that you've approached research at Perspectum. It seems that collaboration with world-renowned researchers and clinicians is really a cornerstone of Perspectum's approach to innovation. Can you maybe highlight a specific collaboration that has been particularly impactful to the company and how it's influenced your product development roadmap?
Yeah, I'm very happy to. In fact, I think this is a central tenet of how we do digital health in the future. One of the big fears, if I start with the fear and come to the solution that might answer it. One of the big fears is that if you do all the research in one place and then apply it globally, it may not be representative. For example, we do loads of work with UK Biobank, which has been very powerful in showing us that, for example, liver disease predicts cardiovascular endpoints. But that's in a 95% white UK population of Caucasians. Does that also apply to African-American populations, Latino populations, Southeast Asian populations? So we decided a long time ago that we are going to be very transparent and acquire data from different populations to actively address the distribution of healthcare research across the different ethnicities and different geographies. So when I look at that and I look at some of our recent work, one collaboration I'm super proud of is we've worked with UT Southwestern and the Dallas Hearts and Minds study to show that liver disease is prevalent in about 10% of the urban population of Dallas. And this is treatable liver disease, so we can immediately start prescribing for these people. We've also worked in Europe with UK Biobank, where the prevalence of liver disease is about 4%. The UK is 2.5 times healthier than urban Dallas, but it's a much more focused population. These are the kind of collaborations and relationships that we've built such that we can collect big data and apply compute power to broad segments of the population. There's always more we can do, but that's very much our ethos.
Mm-hmm. And it would be interesting, I think, in time, once you have large enough data sets to be able to figure out how much of the difference in the incidence of liver disease can be attributed to genetic factors rather than lifestyle factors between those two populations.
Yeah, and that's probably one of the biggest social research questions at the moment. Mm-hmm. How much of our disease burden from obesity should we attribute to nature versus nurture? And the reason that's such an important question to answer is that then determines, on a rational basis, where the taxation should come from. If it's nature, then it's preventative medicine, getting early into schools, childhood nutrition, so on and so forth, and also supportive schemes for parents to allow them to deliver great nutrition to children such that they don't develop obesity if they're at risk of doing so from their genetics.
Yeah.
If it's a nurture problem, if it's an environmental problem, then it almost falls more under sort of ESG legislation and taxation, right? Global efforts to reduce carbon footprint should also then go on to reduce BMI footprints and excess weight footprints.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. As a physician and a scientist, you have a rather unique perspective on the intersection of clinical practice and cutting-edge technology. How do you ensure that prospective solutions remain clinically relevant and user-friendly for healthcare providers?
Very good question. So yeah, you have to start with the premise that doctors are really good at breaking computers. Like, there's no computing classes in med school. I'm 46. Certainly when I went to med school at Oxford, there were no computing classes. And there was actually a lot of resistance to the introduction of electronic health records and systems. And some of that is justified. I now see a lot of patients, especially in the US, complain that their doctors and healthcare providers just look at the screen rather than actually inquire about Amrita's health or how her skin is or how her arms are or what's her blood pressure. So there's a need when one builds a digital product to almost factor in the patient voice into what does a patient want from this if it delivers a report, both on the reassuring side, Amrita, I've got a scan here and the report shows you have no liver disease. My CTO, Matt Robson, who co-founded the company, cheekily suggests that we've made the scan that tells you that you can carry on drinking. But on the other hand, if I'm going to show you a report that suggests that you have excess fat in your liver with or without excess iron and with or without active inflammation, can I do it in a way that the doctor or the nurse looking after you and communicating that report to you has the tool in their hands such that you will understand what's wrong and be able to take corrective actions? Take this drug, drink more coffee, drink more olive oil, don't drink orange juice, these kind of things. And so you're right. When we build a technology that works, in this case, based on medical physics, the end result is not a physics algorithm. It's a clinical report that's FDA cleared, included in clinical guidelines, and specifically designed to communicate to a regular healthcare practitioner and to their patient the extent of someone's liver disease. I have to say it's quite a large piece of work, but once it's been done, it inspires a huge amount of group pride, which means that masochistically, we want to do it again in other organs.
Yeah, absolutely. Your CTO's cheeky comment reminded me of when I was a graduate student in my PhD program at NYU, and I lived in the East Village near a bar. And every morning when I walked to class, the bar had a sign outside that said, "Your liver is your enemy and we're here to help you kill it."
Yeah, we should do events at that bar.
I know. Your background in running clinical trials and your advocacy for smart clinical trial design are evident in Perspectum's approach to evidence generation. Could you share a notable example of how this approach has accelerated the adoption of your technology or influenced regulatory decisions?
Absolutely, yeah. I think the best example here would actually be in fatty liver disease, or what used to be called fatty liver disease, is now called metabolic associated steatotic liver disease. This was a condition which was badly named and all of medicine should put up their hands and agree to never, ever use Latin when English will suffice. But this was a condition that had to be made with a liver biopsy. So remember I told you the story, tissue is the issue, second core MGH. If you said that you thought your patient had had liver disease and you went to a hepatologist, they would immediately refer your patients for a biopsy. Now, God forbid, in the 20% of cases where the biopsy came back near normal, I have the wonderful scenario where I have to reassure you, Amrita, that, hey, good news, you don't have bad liver disease. To which you then promptly thump me and says, well, if I didn't have liver disease, why did you stab me with an 11-centimeter needle? Because it hurts more than it did before. So what has come about is the FDA have looked at the safety of doing repeat biopsies and have made a concerted effort to move away from liver biopsies as their surrogate endpoint for MASH studies in metabolic steatohepatitis. So there are many more clinical trials now being run where liver multiscan has effectively replaced liver biopsy. Not in the phase 3 studies, the registrational ones, we're waiting for someone to grasp that net. But in earlier stage studies, that's already happened. The other thing this has facilitated is the name has been rebranded. It's gone from being non-alcoholic fatty liver disease to metabolic associated steatohepatitis. And in a very legalistic way, because you change the name of the disease, you can have new diagnostic criteria, which now do not include a liver biopsy. So that's progress. I don't have to stab you to make the diagnosis now. That only took 20 years. And then thirdly, you're now seeing in clinical practice, the diagnosis being made without a biopsy and some of the new drugs for liver disease also being covered without a biopsy. So people feel comfortable, insurers feel comfortable paying for a drug to treat liver disease based on liver multiscan alone. And that's not universal, but it took a huge amount of research and collaboration to move the needle that far. But that's something I feel very proud about. The community is moving forward.
Wow, that's a fascinating example. And I love the kind of downstream domino effects of a single change that triggered so many others and really impacted the lives of patients in a positive manner. That's a great story. My next question will be about the rise of digital health technologies in general. Given this rise, along with the importance of things like data security and privacy being top of mind for folks, how does Perspectum address these challenges while at the same time leveraging patient data to improve clinical outcomes?
Great question and very important. So again, I'm the benefit of good luck here. Or I'm benefiting from good luck. When I first started collaborating with physicians in the United States, the first two hospitals I went to were Emory in Atlanta, massive hospital network, very famous for its liver disease research. And the other one was Brooke Army Military Medical Center, which at the time had a very eminent hepatologist called Stephen Harrison, who was leading many clinical trials and loved our technology. He sadly passed away earlier this year. Because, again, this is pure luck, I was doing research with the US military. They were very clear on the cybersecurity standards we would need to meet to be able to access US military data. It's a bit like the late Steve Jobs said, the arc of history is easy to draw backwards. But now when we come to contracting with DOD or US government hospitals, the fact that we were schooled 10 years ago as part of a research collaboration means it's not such a heavy lift 10 years later. Once the work is done and we're in guidelines and people want to use us, it's not such a culture shock to go, oh, wow, cybersecurity is actually really key to contracting. So we've benefited from luck and timing, but it's almost the single biggest issue in healthcare. If you think of the number of people doing AI research, people will get the right solutions. Yeah, if it's not me and it's not Amrita, it'll be someone we know in probably a city that we've been to in an active research group that you probably know of. But whether that answer is regulated is the first hurdle, and whether that answer is safe to deliver So safe to perform on a one-to-one physician-patient basis is one thing. Safe to deliver with thousands of data sets traveling from hospital to server and back is a separate thing. And that's what I think will be a barrier to entry for many emerging academic groups and companies. What I love about our work with AWS and other partners is people are of the same mindset. We know that healthcare is changing and we know the solutions are emerging. And it's incumbent on us to make that climb to the hill of safety easier and signpost it. It's still a hill. There's no way of lowering the standard. You have to have that standard. But my analogy is you can put markers on the best route to climb the hill. You can have a little bench to have a rest because you've known you attained a certain standard, which will get you so far before you climb the next stage. This is how I think the approach to cybersecurity should be. No one should be lowering standards, but we should be standardizing them. Seems obvious, but there are different cybersecurity standards that need to be unified. And we should be making it very clear how to attain those standards.
Yeah, that makes total sense. Again, now I have a slightly related question on the role of AI and how you envision that AI and machine learning will help in achieving this vision of personalized medical care, particularly in the context of interpreting very complex medical imaging data.
Yeah, no, I think the easiest way to think of this is phone numbers and lists. So medical students are very good at learning lists. They're probably top of any discipline for learning lists, okay? And probably the best medical school in the world for this is the All India Institute of Medical Sciences, AIIMS, right? Which is one of the toughest universities in India, if not the world, to get into with a level of competition that makes the Olympics look like a play date, okay? And what do you do when you get in there? You learn all the causes of all the disease. It's encyclopedic knowledge that comes out of these medical graduates, right? So they know all the complications that you could possibly get from an antibiotic, an anti-inflammatory drug, all the complications that may arise from a medical condition like psoriasis and so on and so forth. And that was all powerful until the computer came along. A computer, even though it doesn't know anything, can record lists. And that was compounded by the fact that we now have diagnostic criteria that go beyond 12. So people can learn lists of up to 12. But then when you have to learn the entire genetic code, even the best student in AIIMS can't do that, right? So now we have people who are great at learning lists, but lists that are longer than even the best can learn, and more lists, right? So we don't just have the genetic code, we have more complex imaging. In the 1980s, you were lucky if you got a chest x-ray. In the 2000s, or noughties as we call them in the UK, you had a CT scan. Now you get MRI scans with quantitative tissue data and virtual biopsies. No one can learn those lists. So we need compute power to assess that and determine whether Amrita has PNPLA3 genotype with fat level of X and inflammation of Y and iron level of Z, none of which could be discernible from the human eye. The bit that artificial intelligence cannot do is communicate that while looking you in the eye and explaining that it's going to be okay, but it will take 4 months to recover. And this is the kind of diet that you should take. And this is the kind of preventive action that will work for you in the context of your life. So are doctors going to be made redundant? Absolutely not. But is the kind of medicine that required long list learning going to be made redundant? Almost certainly, yes.
It's fascinating to see the evolution of where and how a physician can, or a medical student in training, can add value. And it's really fascinating to see how that's changed over time. That AIIMS example is a good one. And I don't know how many of our listeners know this, but yes, the All India Institute of Medical Sciences is indeed one of the most selective, if not the most selective, medical school that one can hope to get into.
And the other thing is, it's a world leader in medical science. And what have they done? They've introduced AI into the curriculum. They get it. Yeah.
They get it. Yeah. So as CEO, when you look ahead, where do you see the biggest opportunities and challenges for Perspective, both in terms of advancing precision medicine and also, you know, maximizing impact on patient care globally?
I'm 46 now. By the time I'm 56, maybe 60, I'd like to think patients will find it safer because they won't be stabbed. They'll get their diagnosis faster because they won't have to wait to be stabbed, and they'll be able to see the whole of their insides quicker, and we'll be able to compute more complex phenotypes or distributions of disease by, for example, looking at someone who has disease in their pancreas and in their liver and in their kidney and putting it all together and say, you have condition X. So improved patient safety, improved diagnostic rates, and those come together to make improved patient outcomes. So I would say that a hospital or a unit that was using our technology would have better outcomes than a group that was not. And we've seen that in cancer care in the UK. We ran a study in 94 patients where we changed the type of surgery that was done in 40% of patients. That's quite a big deal. And those patients went on to do better than had they not had our scan. That's a research study, and it's quite limited, 94, not even 100. But if you ask me what I want, if we can translate that so that goes into real-world clinical practice, that'll be even better than getting rid of the biopsy from the liver story.
Amazing. And so I'd like to end with one final question to you, and it's actually a two-part question. We always ask our podcast guests to leave some advice for entrepreneurs and founders who may be thinking of founding a healthcare and life sciences startup. But before that, when we were chatting earlier, you had shared a little bit about the story of your parents and how they arrived in the UK. We talk a lot about women in tech today, and your mom was really a pioneer in this field when she came to the UK and started working in information technology. So my first question would be, would you like to share a little bit of your mom's journey and how that's influenced you in your career choices? And secondly, what advice would you have for academic researchers or physicians who may be thinking about starting on this entrepreneurial journey?
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for remembering my mom. I should do so more often too. So my mom came to the UK in the early 1970s because she'd done incredibly well in maths in her college in India. And she got a scholarship to come and do a master's in the UK. And she could do either maths or computing, which at that stage was a branch of mathematics and a bit of a sort of out there branch of mathematics. And she thought she'd just take a punt on it because it seemed interesting. And so she was the first female Asian sari-wearing computer scientist in the UK. And that had some pros and some cons. She had old dialogues. And remember, this predates email. So there were actual written letters exchanged with Bill Gates about accessing disks. She had to queue for compute time. So we think now of like compute time as like a computer, a bigger computer. I want a bigger computer. Back then, there was like one computer between 50. And if you didn't argue well, you got the 2 a.m. to 4 a.m. spot. And she did incredibly well. I'm her only child, and my father was an engineer. So clearly, I was hopeless at computing and hopeless at engineering, which is why I went into medicine. I must be the only Asian, only child in history where both their parents almost started crying when I said I was going to medical school.
Not tears of joy.
But they were so supportive through me. As I came through my 20s and into my 30s and then moved back into research, that sort of made them happier again. And starting the company was something my dad was hugely supportive of. It slightly upset my mother because I was about to become a consultant cardiologist. And she was like, finally, I can go to all the relatives and say, I'm so proud of you, you're a consultant cardiologist. And now you're going to throw that away and start a company. And I don't know, what's this liver thing? But my dad always supported the idea of doing new things. He said to me, everybody dies. If you're going to die by a mistake, make sure it's your own mistake, not somebody else's. So I guess that's the, so that he leaves to people who want to start their own companies. But yeah, my mom's very cool.
What a great story to end with, Rajarshi Banjo. It's been amazing having you on the podcast, and thank you so much for joining us today.
No trouble at all. Thank you for having me, Amrita, and thank you for all the listeners.
Thanks for joining us today for the AWS Health Innovation Podcast. If you want to get in touch with AWS, please check out our show notes where you can find a link. If you enjoy the podcast, the best way to support us is to share it with your colleagues and friends. We also really appreciate your reviews and ratings wherever you listen to podcasts. We love hearing feedback from our listeners, so please don't hesitate to get in touch. Again, you'll find all the details in our show notes. See you next week.